Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Today, we have access to a wide range of interactive devices, many of them very portable, easily fitting in a pocket or a purse, things that let us search for information, talk to one another, listen to music, and, of course, shop for just about anything. Now, one can argue that there are certain things that we gain from having these devices with us. In exchange, though, there are downsides. In fact, one of the things that we lose, whatever we may gain, one of the things we lose is privacy, as our communications are tracked without our permission, in some cases, perhaps in many cases, without our knowledge. So the question is, how is that information being used and who benefits? What are the costs and the benefits of this kind of technology that's now becoming so common? Well, those are some of the questions we'll try to take up this morning with our guest, Mark Andreevich. He is an associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. He is also a fellow with the Center for Critical and Cultural Studies at the University of Queensland in Australia. And he is the author of a recent book. The title is I Spy, Surveillance and Power in the Interactive Era. It's published by the University Press of Kansas. Questions are welcome as we talk. All you need to do is dial the phone. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. Let me try that one again. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, I should go more slowly. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Okay, and also the toll-free line is 800-222-9455. At any point here you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. We just ask callers to be brief in their comments and questions so we can keep things moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor Andreevich, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, perhaps the place to start out is to ask you to talk a little bit about the title of the book. And I want to say to people here that the I in the title, I Spy, is a lowercase I. And clearly what you are encouraging people to think about is the all of those devices that we now have that are called I something, like iPhones or iPods. And about now our tendency to attach that lowercase I to a number of other words, as you do in the book, to describe the kind of digital landscape that we have now. So what is it you're trying to get at with that that little I?
Well, beside making it a nightmare for cataloging, what the little I for the book title, the little I is it's put on all of these terms in order to designate interactivity. And the goal of the book is to offer what I think of as a critique of the promise of interactivity. And you put it nicely in the introduction, that on the one hand, we're offered a wide range of conveniences. And I don't want to downplay all of the forms of convenience that are coming with these, the proliferation of digital interactive devices. But I think much less attention has been paid to the way in which the forms of interactivity that they facilitate double as technologies for surveillance, monitoring, and information gathering. Since you pick that term, I also like it because it resonates with a kind of promise of a subjective empowerment. You know, and I think you know iMac or iPhone. It makes it a sound also like it's mine, iPhone. and there's a way in which this aligns with the promise of interactivity, which is that providing information about yourself is a way of expressing yourself, saying who you are. And there's a kind of invitation to interact, which is portrayed, even though marketers are using this information in order to gain certain types of strategic advantage when it comes to marketing to individuals. Mm-hmm. The use of the word I is meant to portray that strategic advantage that they're gaining as actually a form of self-expression, of your own self-growth and self-awareness and self-knowledge. And I think there's something kind of false in that promise. So all of that is in that little I, yeah. Or at least I I try to freight it with all of those implications.
Well, that's true. When you think about it, that's truly a wonderful piece of marketing. That in the face of all of the other concerns, and I'm sure we'll be talking about some of these things, particularly concerns that have to do with privacy, that these devices should be sold to us with the promise of freedom. This is the thing, just what they're saying to us is, look at all of the great things that you will be able to do with this thing. It expands your possibilities, expands your horizons. And of course, if it's wireless, that it means that then you can take that thing with you wherever you go. That's really the promise. And as you say, that's not a completely empty promise. Yes, it will indeed do that. But I think that sometimes we are seduced by the promise, and we don't think about the potential downsides, and in fact, there are some.
Yeah, I think it works as a promise because the advantages are real, and the advantages are quite direct and palpable. We can feel it, you know, when we are able to call our friends wherever we happen to be on the street. I'm somebody who was raised in the era prior to mobile telephony, at least on a mass scale, and, you know, the changes that's made in terms of convenience and communication are dramatic. The same can be said for a number of interactive applications that are available to us, the internet, social networking sites, YouTube, all of these technologies that make it possible to either gather information or share information in ways that are really unprecedented. So the promise is real. I think the task that motivated me in any case to write the book was to push a little bit further, because along with these conveniences, there's a whole rhetoric of empowerment that seems to be a little bit over the top. So if you remember the Time Magazine Person of the Year feature, I think it was the Person of the Year 2006, is you.
Mm-hmm.
And the claim there was that distributed users are seizing control over the means of media production, and this is represents a fundamental power shift in society and a fundamental form of democratization, making contributing to a more equitable, in terms of power, a nation in which power is more equitably distributed. That I think is pushing it a little bit too far. So the project of the book is to say, is to ask the question, what would it be like if interactivity really did deliver on the forms of empowerment that are being promised for it, or in a kind of counterfactual way, how is it that the forms of interactivity that are being offered to us, even though they're portrayed as forms of quite powerful empowerment, are not quite as empowering as they look, and that in fact... what's happening in some cases is the collection of huge amounts of information about consumers and telephone users and social networkers that's put in the hands of people who are interested in exerting certain forms of power over and control over those people. So there are certain forms of state surveillance that are facilitated by interactive media technologies, and there are certain forms of commercial surveillance that are facilitated. Advertisers can potentially gather more information than ever before, and not only gather information about consumers, but experiment on consumers, run series of ongoing controlled experiments to find out what types of appeals work best for which type of consumers. And ultimately, that's a game of influence. Advertisers are trying to gain influence over us. They're trying to influence our behavior. And the power that they gain through interactive technologies may prove to be significant. And that's something that I think it's important to think about against this background of the promise of we consumers are actually becoming more empowered.
Yeah. Our guest is Mark Andreevich. He's associate professor in the Department of Speech and the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also fellow at the Center for Critical and Cultural Studies at University of Queensland and is author of the book I Spy, Surveillance and Power in the Interactive Era. The book is published by University Press of Kansas. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In a sense, the question I'm about to ask, you have already begun to answer it in talking about the themes of the book, but let me ask it in a sort of a direct way, because because you do early on in the book say, write something to the effect that it's not, you didn't really set out to write a book about loss of privacy, even though that's certainly a legitimate concern and people have written about it. I think that's an aspect that has certainly got a lot of attention in mainstream media and from scholars both. But if that's not the thing that you want to concentrate on, then what is it? I mean, is it in fact the thing that you were already talking about, and that is, well, you know, what do they say, the people who are purveying this technology, what do they say that we're going to get, and then what do we really get?
Thank you for asking that question. I think it's an important one. I'll say a couple of things about it. One, the reason why I didn't focus on the issue of privacy, and second, where I think the focus should be, which is on questions of power and influence. The interesting thing to me about privacy, and I'm sure this experience will be shared by anyone in the audience there who's had some experience with teenagers today or young kids or students or taught them, is that if you talk to the generation of users who kind of have been growing up accustomed to having these interactive technologies available to them and to signing away control over their personal information with every website that they go to and to disclosing all types of information about themselves via social networking sites like MySpace or Facebook, the issue of privacy is not one that resonates with them particularly. You know, you talk to them about privacy and they kind of shrug their shoulders. Well, yeah, okay, you know, I understand this in some abstract way, this is a concern, but in quite practical terms, I don't feel any direct consequences of possible surrender of privacy, but I do feel the concrete benefits of these applications that I have. The only moment that I can remember when some of the students that I was teaching really perked up and listened when we were talking about privacy was the example of prospective employers going on to Facebook and finding information about job applicants. And that was a moment where they thought, oh, that's kind of creepy. You know, maybe I should be careful about what types of things I disclose on this site and what types of pictures I make available. And it also made them think a little bit about what are the implications of forms of self-disclosure which endure over time and travel over space in ways that maybe they haven't quite habituated themselves to. They understand how Facebook works, but maybe they haven't experienced potential long-term consequences that would make them think about what does it mean if the pictures or the sentiments that I post are going to be available 10 years from now in some archive and can be searched and captured and retrieved. That's a kind of long-term thinking which people haven't yet had to incorporate into their online behavior. And the second reason that to stick on this privacy question, that I don't focus a lot on the question of privacy, is because it's a kind of double-edged sword. On the one hand, when we talk about loss of privacy, it's not quite accurate as a formulation for what's going on in the context that I'm looking at, interactive media technologies that gather information about consumers and users. Because what's happening in many cases is, whereas information about myself, what I do on a website or the contents of my email if I use Gmail, may be available to others who I don't have much control over and who I don't even know may be accessing my information. And in that sense, I experience potentially a type of loss of privacy. That information is also being privatized. It's becoming the property of the companies that collect it. And so there's a kind of privatization of personal information taking place. And the discussion around loss of privacy doesn't quite take into account that element of what's taking place. Mm-hmm. So what I try to do instead of talking about privacy is talk about questions of power. And also, I try to frame the activities that take place in these interactive contexts as a form not just of self-disclosure or not just of accessing convenience on the part of consumers, but also a form of productivity. So to make that a little bit more concrete, I can give you an example of some of the things I've been looking at more recently. Google and other companies, but Google in particular, has filed a patent for technology that would allow it to track the behavior of online gamers as they play games, in order to gather details about their style of play, who they're communicating with, and what, if any, other online activities they're engaged in as they play these video games online, in order to be able to market them more, to target market them more effectively. And the language in the patent is interesting. It refers to what might be described as a form of psychographic profiling. How can we figure out what type of personality this person is based on their style of game or of gameplay, or at least maybe what type of fantasies they have and what type of character they aspire to be, and how might that information enter into some kind of a calculus that would allow us to persuade them to consume particular products or services more effectively. Well, what that effectively means is that consumers are engaged in the process of doing the type of work that market researchers used to be paid to do, right? So there's a form of, if you go back early in the 20th century with the development of the marketing industry, you can see this kind of labor-intensive aspect of an industry that's interested in gathering as much information as possible about consumers in order to manage them more effectively. So early on, there were some experiments, a famous one, the guy who founded the ratings industry actually won a prize from Harvard Business School for an experiment that he conducted in gathering all of the, finding selected, desirable consumers and trying to figure out the details of the types of products and the combinations of products that they bought. And rather than going to their house and asking them and poking through their cupboards and so on, what he did was he arranged for them to deliver him their trash. And he and his coworkers gathered trash bags from all of these homes, took them to a big sorting facility, and poured through them to see what type of products and in what combination desirable demographics of consumers were purchasing. This is a lot of work. It's quite labor-intensive, not to mention messy. What the interactive applications make possible is for consumers to provide this type of information and much, much more on their own through the very process of interacting with the companies or the service providers that they're interacting with. So they're engaged in a productive activity. In fact, they're generating information that has value, the basically information commodities about consumers that can be bought and sold. So companies that gather detailed statistics about consumers have these demographic commodities that they can trade in. And it's the consumers themselves who are generating it. I frame it this way in order to suggest that in addition to questions of privacy, we're also talking about questions of who controls information resources, and via their ability to control it, who's able to capture the value of the productivity of consumers and citizens as they engage in online activities. Mm-hmm. That's a long-winded answer.
Well, that then suggested a couple of other questions. And first, of course, would be the question of consent. And I'm sure that you would argue and other people would argue that if this kind of information is going to be collected about us, we should at the very least be able to say yes or no. But going beyond that, then the sort of the next level is, if we say yes, then we and whoever's collecting information have to acknowledge it has value, and so that we're entitled to something, and probably something more than just a token. But getting anything, any kind of recompense that's worth to us, anything close to what this is worth to the people who are collecting the data, I'm not sure that might not be too much to expect.
There have been people who suggested schemes where consumers and online users set some type of a price for their information. I agree with you. I don't think that's a particularly practical scheme, and it doesn't quite get it. The types of concerns I'm interested in, because it still frames it as an individual transaction, and what I'm interested in are the arrangements that structure those individual transactions. You know, the very fact that, for example, social networking sites are commercially supported. One could imagine a different arrangement in which social networking sites were nonprofit sites or, funded through taxes or some other way of making this type of sociability available to consumers. But we've got an arrangement that looks like it's going to be the dominant one for some time coming, which is a commercial arrangement. And that commercial arrangement means that certain people are going to, one group, namely the people who own and control these sites, are going to have control over the information that they collect. And the process of consent is such a tricky one. You know, when you agree, and currently, when we go on all of these different applications, we engage in agreeing to legal documents. So at some unprecedented level, usually without reading them. You know, we have, if you go and look at those privacy agreements or end-user license agreements, they do have legal language about, what type of information could be gathered and what might be done with it. But it's incredibly general and incredibly vague. And, of course, you have to agree to it in order to have access to the site. And most people, when they're going to these sites, have already decided in advance, I want to get on Facebook. I want to be able to use this website. So whatever they ask, I'm going to click on it and agree. If I don't click, I don't have any recourse. I don't have any other choice. and what they agree to tend to be things that are so vague, it's very hard to construe that as informed consent. So, you know, things like any information that might be relevant for marketing to you. Well, what would that include? for marketers, that could include anything. Details of, you know, anything that could be garnered about our personal life or healthcare concerns. Pretty much all personal information has some type of potential relevance to marketers. I'm not sure. And the other thing that happens often in those end-user license agreements is they say that they're subject to change without notification. So you end up agreeing to something that sounds like a legal contract, but it's subject to change at any time without notification, which it's hard to even construe that as a contract. The notion of meaningful informed consent in that context, I think, is worthless. It's not really what's happening.
We're in a midpoint already, and I have a caller here, and let me again introduce the guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. Mark Andreevich is associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. He's also a fellow at the Center for Critical and Cultural Studies at the University of Queensland. That's in Australia. He's the author of the book Reality TV, The Work of Being Watched. And the book that we're talking about here this morning, the title is I Spy, Surveillance and Power in the Interactive Era, published by the University Press of Kansas. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, comments, you want to be a part of the conversation, you can call us. We have somebody here to bring in. They're in Savoy on our toll-free line, so we'll go right there. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting show. Thanks for taking my call. Your guest really sparked my imagination. I have a quick story to relate, I think, that dovetails right into what he's talking about. There is a discount store that we go to, and the offer is you can win $1 million if you go online and put in your receipt number and your how much you spent and all this kind of stuff. You just kind of couple of clicks, and you know, you can enter as many times as you want. You can win $1 million. And well, I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. And then I'm reading the fine print, and it's $1 million paid $50,000 a year over 20 years. And then with your guests, the feedback from your guests, I'm thinking, well, what company wouldn't want to pay $50,000 for all this information of what store you went to and what you bought and how much you spent. And there's only one winner, and I'm guessing the odds are probably infinitesimal. So they're getting all this information from all these consumers, and all they have to spend is $50,000, and I'm sure they're looking at it as quite a bargain. And of course, people are thinking, well, I could win $1 million, but it's in the fine print, and by plugging in the code on the receipt and everything, you're telling this company exactly what you're spending, how much, and where you're going. And anyway, I thought that dovetailed into what your guest was talking about. I'd be interested in his comments. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. That's a great example of an information gathering practice it's been around for a while, and it's something that the internet makes easier and faster than ever before. The caller and the audience are probably familiar with these loyalty shopping cards that often you get at your supermarket or your drugstore. And these cards operate on a similar principle, except they don't offer you, one person the possibility of a cash prize. They offer the prospect of discounts on selected items at selected times. But an interesting study was done by I think it was the group called Caspian that is concerned about the privacy implication of these loyalty cards, and they compared the prices at stores that had loyalty cards and stores that didn't. And what they discovered in the end was that stores that didn't have loyalty cards actually had slightly lower prices overall. And if you went to the store that did have the loyalty cards, if you didn't surrender the information about yourself, you ended up actually paying higher prices than the stores that didn't have these cards at all. In other words, your choice was either to surrender the information about yourself or pay more for the products that you consume. And again, it's a way to attempt to gather information in order to further systematize and rationalize the marketing process in order to be able to sell products more efficiently and faster to consumers. Now, up to a point, that may be something that consumers would say, yeah, well, isn't that a good thing? Don't we want to have? And this is the point that I run into all the time when I make these arguments. People say, well, don't you want to live in a society in which advertisers and marketers provide you with advertising appeals that are relevant to who you are? Well, what's wrong with that? It's better than getting ads if you don't have a dog, and you're barraged with dog food ads. Isn't that just a kind of waste of your time and a waste of everybody's time? Wouldn't you rather be barraged with ads that are relevant to your interests and concerns? And I think certainly there is a point there. The question to me is, it's that always frames advertising as if it's a purely informational practice, as if what advertising is really about is just telling us about those desires and products the desires that we already have and the products that we already feel that we have a need for, and we just needed to have somebody tell us, where they are and how cheap they are. Whereas in reality, the industry, I think there's some more going on there. It's also about not only inducing desires in certain cases, but also preying on fears and anxieties and insecurities. There are different types of advertising, and some I think are more pernicious, and we might not feel as comfortable with them as others. Certainly, we're comfortable with ads that are related to our interests. We're willing to buy magazines for related to our hobbies in order to, in part, to see the ads that are related to what we're interested in. But what about a world in which companies are able to gather information about sensitive personal issues in our private lives, or even details of medical conditions that are supposed to be protected? But if you end up Googling information about a medical condition that you may have or be concerned that you have, that's information that advertisers can right away use to try to prey on particular fears or anxieties or insecurities. At some point, I think there's going to be, we're going to have to confront that question of where do we draw the line in terms of our comfort level regarding the strategies that advertisers are able to use, the quantity of information that they have about us, and their ability to influence us in ways that are not purely reducible to, here's something that we already know you're interested in.
Another caller here, Clay City, Illinois. This is line one.
Yes, my call is about the total impact of technology. I just read an article where the Chicago Tribune is getting ready to file bankruptcy, and one of the reasons that they're filing bankruptcy is the impact that companies like Craigslist and free services have had. My children are all grown, and my daughter, all three of my daughters have gotten apartments without ever going to the newspaper. I bought furniture without ever looking at a newspaper, at any kind of print ad, done everything over the Craigslist. What's the real world impact of that on the technology sector? And just, is somebody trying to get a handle on that? And will there someday somebody put a throttle around that where I could get some things free and I'm going to have to pay for them? You see what I'm saying? I just wonder what the impact he thinks is going to have on the society in that way. Bye.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's everything is in motion at this point, and I don't know overall what the long-term impact is going to be for industries like newspapers and so on, but I can give you some thoughts on some of the patterns that you pointed to, and you're very right. You know, Craigslist is something that's devastating the newspaper industry because of the ways that it's cutting into classified advertising, or at least it's devastating those publications that relied pretty heavily on classified advertising. Something like USA Today, which was a national newspaper, didn't have the same type of local markets as something like the Chicago Tribune or which has a national market and a local market, or other more local and regional newspapers. Most of what I've seen is pretty negative about the future of the newspaper industry. That doesn't necessarily mean that the industry won't find other ways to support itself. It does mean that it's going to have to adjust to a changing economic scene. One of the other things that is taking place online is the growth of alternative forms of news production, so not a print regional or local newspaper, but things like these news-oriented blogs or online websites, which run the gamut from quite extreme and ideological and often unreliable to quite highly professional and rigorous and investigative, and those are also threatening more conventional media outlets, even as they tend to rely on them. And I suspect we're going to see a fundamental rearrangement of the economics of the media industry in the wake of these transformations. And one of the things that we're seeing is, and I suspect also that it's going to rely on this interactive commercial logic that I've been targeting, the ability to make the case that, well, we can't do what we used to do, which is provide a kind of cheap outlet for people to sell secondhand goods and rent newspapers and rent apartments and so on. But what we might be able to do is offer certain forms of targeted niche marketing that previously media outlets were unable to deliver. So just to give you another example, a few years ago, Google had a plan to provide free internet access to all of downtown San Francisco. The plan ended up falling through. Their partner backed out on this. But they had a business model. They were going to make the internet available to anybody in the city via Wi-Fi. But when you got on, you had to enter some information about yourself, and the network would gather information about where you were in the city. And that would be used to custom target advertising to you based on your location. This opens up new markets. So even as something like classified ads disappear, that type of a model makes it possible for a local pizza joint or a bookstore to buy advertising from a national corporation, but have it targeted just to the region around them, so create a kind of new form of niche marketing. Will that end up being enough to support media outlets as we know them? I don't know the answer to that. I think that remains an open question. Mm.
Well, this gives me an opportunity to ask you to talk about something that I was just I'm so glad you're at this point, because I wanted to have you talk a little bit about the idea of a digital enclosure. And here you're setting up just that very example. That's what people were talking about doing there in San Francisco. And you can imagine, so you get this citywide Wi-Fi, and so you head out to the park with your laptop, and you're sitting there and you're working along. And so whoever conducts or collects the information, they know who you are. They know where you are. They know what you like. They know where you go for coffee. They know what books you like to read. They know what you like to have for lunch. They know all kinds of things. So they're here in the opportunity to target you with all sorts of advertising about, you know, right across the street from where you are, there's a great coffee shop. Or we understood that you like to read mystery novels, but did you know that just around the block there was a store that has, you know, there's a great bookstore? Or it's getting near lunchtime and they know that you like Mexican food. And so pops on your screen an ad for a Mexican restaurant that's a block away from where you are. That's, for marketers, that's sort of the idea. How I guess the question when it comes to the idea of the digital enclosure is, are we there already?
First, I'll thank you for bringing up that notion of digital enclosure. I use that to describe a world in which activities that used to take place in forms that were not monitorable are increasingly being enfolded into this embrace of digital technology, which allows them to become monitorable activities, to generate information about themselves. So you think of writing a letter, for example, and I remember doing this when I was a kid, you know, writing to your grandparents and so on. That required an agency that would carry the letter, but they didn't have the ability to look in, and they didn't gather and record information about when you wrote it and when it was delivered and when someone opened it. Now, much of my correspondence has been replaced by email, and if you think of a company like Google, which not only keeps track of how many people you email, when, what your patterns of mail behavior are, but it actually has access to the contents of your email, which it uses to customize advertising to you. So as activities that were non-digital become encompassed by digital technology, they start to generate more and more detailed information about all of the things, all of the aspects of our lives that enter into it. I think social networking sites are very interesting too, because they actually take, it's not quite right to say this, but they take forms of socialization that used to take place in a non-monitored context and fold them into a context in which every time, you know, you contact a friend or take a look at what they're doing, that generates data about your activity and your friend's activity. And it also creates new forms of sociability that generate more and more detailed information about us. Having said that, getting to your question, are we there yet? I think in some ways we're not quite there yet, because the level of information gathering and the effectiveness of its use for marketing, I'm not sure it's reached the level that the people who are envisioning this economic model and technology have been striving for. They want something that's just kind of so seamlessly perfect in terms of influencing us as we go through the course of our day. And I'm not sure they've reached that point. You know, a lot of people, if you talk to them about Facebook, they'll say, well, yeah, well, I don't even, you know, look at the ads on Facebook. Oftentimes, customized advertising, if you've ever had the experience of going to a website and having ads that pop up based on your previous activity. For example, I've searched for on an online travel site for tickets to go to a particular location, and I haven't purchased them. But then when I log on and I go to another website, up pops an ad that says, you know, tickets to such and such a city from your city available at this website. You know, clearly they know where you've been and what you were looking for. This happens to me in Australia all the time. I go on trying to find some information about the U.S., because of my friends and family here, and they feed me information about Australia all the time because they know I'm logging in from Australia. So I think the system hasn't been perfected. It's actually quite far from being perfected. The interesting thing to me is the fantasy of perfection, which is perfect information and perfect transparency of consumers. We're still a long way from that. I don't know if we'll ever get there. But I think one thing we can count on is that the people who are developing this technology for commercial purposes, their goal is going to be to get there. It's going to be to gather more and more powerful portraits of each of us in order to be able to manipulate us for the purposes of consumption more effectively.
Just real quick, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Mark Andreevich, associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies at University of Iowa. He's also fellow at the Center for Critical and Cultural Studies at University of Queensland in Australia. He's the author of the book I Spy, Surveillance and Power in the Interactive Era. It's published by the University Press of Kansas. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, given the fact that that sort of perfect level of the digital enclosure that some people might like to see, maybe that we'll never get there, one would have to say is that we've made some progress. We're some ways down the road, at least in that direction. And given that, and given the fact that there are a lot of people on the planet today that know nothing else, that they were born into this world, and they take the kind of interactivity that we're talking about for granted, then perhaps the question is there no way to turn around? Are we just going to continue to go down the road and get as close to living in the digital enclosure as it's possible to get?
I don't think there's no way to turn around, although I also don't think it's particularly easy to turn around. Mm-hmm. The thing that concerns me, and one of the reasons that I wrote the book, is the notion that there's a certain type of habituation associated with these practices. So as they gradually ramp up, we get used to them as they develop. You think of the proverbial frog in the pot of boiling water. You raise the pot a degree, and the frog never notices until it's cooked. It seems to me to be important to point out that the temperature is rising rather than just habituating ourselves to it. I do think that I often wonder what might have to take place in order for us to reconsider the direction in which we're going. And I suspect one of the things is going to be concerns about the implications of certain types of information that becomes available. So when it gets to the point, if it gets to the point that, for example, health insurance providers, we find that they're actually able to screen out clients, if indeed we have this type of a system in the future, if they're able to deny coverage to people based on information they've acquired about them through their online activities in the digital enclosure. When we see that type of thing happening, I suspect that might be a moment when enough popular consensus emerges to create regulations and a legal infrastructure that controls how information is collected and what's done with it. And I do think in the end what's going to have to take place is some type of a system for regulating and controlling the capture and use of information. Now, if you talk to people in the technology world about this, they tend to laugh because they have a very strong belief that the technology always finds its way around laws and regulations, and that may be the experience of people who, for example, are thinking about questions like illegal file sharing online. It's illegal, there's a law against it, and yet it becomes very hard to trace and contain. I think this will end up being a struggle. And it's not clear to me that the outcome is that we'll be able to effectively, collectively harness and control the technology that we've unleashed. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that we're able to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the attributes of human society. We have the capacity to do that. But if we abdicate that capacity, or let me put it this way, we tend to have it or we have a tendency towards abdicating that capacity and just saying, you know what, you can't control the technology. You have to just let it advance where it's going. But of course, that assumes a particular economic model, you know, that it's all of these things are going to be provided commercially. And it ignores the ways in which that economic model relies on systems of political regulation and legal regulation. Yeah.
Well, do you think that we're going to have to draw some line, though, and we might have to be willing to say, okay, maybe I truly don't care if someone knows what I buy at the grocery store, but that there are certain kinds of information that I really do need to keep control of, for example, information about my health or what kind of medications I'm taking, or, you know, who knows, that we ought to at least go right to the most important stuff first, and maybe say, well, maybe there are some other things that we can live with and we won't worry about that on that end, but on the high end, we need to start right away.
I do think that's important to do, and most legal systems that I've encountered do have that type of a structure. They identify what's considered to be protected information, and there are stronger controls over that type of information. Although, here, an interesting example, there was a consortium of advertisers a while back that made an agreement regarding what type of medical conditions they would exclude from their practices of online marketing. And the assumption there was that they were able to gather enough information about the activities of people online to, without having access in any way to their medical records, to divine what type of illnesses they may be experiencing and that they might be relevant target markets for. So they came up with things, you know, that we won't market to people based on our assumption that they have HIV/AIDS based on their patterns of online behavior. Again, not based on access to their medical information. So the point I'm trying to make here is there are some forms of information that are protected categories of information that even if you don't have access to it directly, you're able to divine or infer from gathering other types of information online. What's the remedy for that? One of the things that occurs to me, although I'm sometimes hesitant to forward this, is more monitoring, but not of consumers this time, but of advertisers and marketers. So, you know, what would be the implications of, for example, making it a requirement that all personal information gathered about any consumer should be subject to disclosure on the part of marketers? If you want to find out what they know about you, you should be able to go to them and ask, and they will have to turn over all the information that they have, and they'll have to turn over information about how they're using it. I think that a certain level of scrutiny or accountability might also force accountability on the part of these companies to consumer concerns. If they know they're going to be busted, if they use particular types of information, and if they know that there's some type of legal sanction for that, I think that that might have a deterrent effect on them.
Okay, we'll try to get one, maybe two more callers in. First in line here, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes. It's been said that they have greater over structure to protect the consumer in France, and I was wondering if you would comment on that. And then the second question is if you are aware of any technologies that are coming down the pipe that might be pretty much like the radar detectors that you know, people can use to see if the state trooper is looking at them, you know, that are pertinent to this sort of thing of this consumer surveillance. Thank you.
All right. That's an interesting question.
Thanks. Great questions. The European Union does tend to have stronger privacy protection regimes than the U.S. However, they tend to be hard to enforce, especially in a context in which information gathering and use is taking place online in places that by companies that you know, maybe based outside of the European Union, or this is what I've encountered in Australia. Local privacy regulations are circumvented by the end user license agreements that consumers consent to when they use a particular website. So, for example, the rule may be that information about consumers is not allowed to be transferred to overseas databases. But when you go on a website like Facebook in Australia, the end user license agreement says by clicking on this terms of use agreement, you agree to have your information transferred to the United States. So it becomes I don't want to diminish the difficulty of developing a regulatory framework. I think it's a challenging task in the internet era. The second question, I'm not aware of technologies that would allow one to detect surveillance as it takes place. You know, to have a pop-up on your computer screen appear when personal information about you is being collected. Although I like the idea, I think it would be very interesting to ask members of the public if that's a type of control they would like to have in place. What I am aware of are technologies that allow you to engage in anonymizing your online behavior, for example. So an internet browser that makes it hard for advertisers to gather information about the details of what search terms you enter and where you go online, the type of information that's routinely gathered and can be quite revealing. So there are applications that allow you to anonymize your internet activity, and that's one type of a protection that people who are concerned about this engage in.
We are going to have to stop. I'm sorry, we have a couple of callers that we can't take. I'm sure on future shows we'll get back to some of these issues. For the moment, if you'd like to read more on this subject, the book that we have mentioned is I Spy, and that's the lowercase I Spy, Surveillance and Power in the Interactive Era. Mark Andreevich is the guest. He's associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies at University of Iowa. He's also fellow at the Center for Critical and Cultural Studies at the University of Queensland in Australia. The book's published by University Press of Kansas. And Professor Andreevich, thanks very much.
Thank you.